Tell me something about what it meant to change your identity to an Israeli.
My identity as a Jew was never ever questioned, or that was a given. That was very strongly part of me. My mother used to tell the story how when I was born and she gave me the name Naomi, that's the Hebrew pronunciation of the biblical Naomi, and then Noemi, the way it is spelled, is the Hungarian spelling. Her brother said to her, how can you give such a name to a girl? This was like too biblical, too Jewish, 1941. And I was not given any other name. When we got off the boat in Haifa in December, the first night of Hanukkah, in 1948, I still remember how there were these clerks with desks greeting the newcomers, and they were giving them what's called Teudat Ole, which is like an ID card, an immigrant ID card, the first identification card, and they were asking them for Jewish names, and some had, some didn't, or whatever. Anyway, I don't remember the details. I remember how I experienced it. They asked me what my name was, and I said, Naomi. And the clerk was thrilled. Here is this Jewish child with a Hebrew name, and there was no other name. And it was like I was legitimized. I have finally arrived where I belong, where even my name is accepted, and it's part of the majority culture, if you will. Win. Freudian slip. I won.
But you weren't, to coin a phrase, you weren't Hungarian anymore.
No. Oh, that's right. Oh, that's a wonderful story. I might as well tell that story. We were put on big trucks. They were taking us to this, the absorption center. And those, it was a mass aliyah. I mean, the next 3 years, there were so many people coming in. But we were amongst the first ones to come following the War of Independence. And so we were on these big trucks going from Haifa to Be'er Yaakov, which is south of Tel Aviv. So it's like a couple of hours, actually longer in those days. On the road, there were workers on the sides. And one of the workers heard the Hungarian. Everybody was speaking Hungarian. So a man shouts up, Hungarians, Hungarians, Magyarok, Magyarok. So my mother shouts down, Nem Magyarok, not Hungarians, Zsidok, Jews. And I guess that's what I got, with my, as they say, my mother's milk, that kind of an identity, that strong identity. And it just became the Jewish was the foundation, and then the Israeli became integrated into it. I don't know exactly. I mean, I still see myself as primarily Jewish and then Israeli, but the two are really part and parcel. One, they are together.
What was the reaction post-war in Israel to the Holocaust? Was there a lot of talk about it?
I lived a double life. It was very interesting. I think that, since then I left, I read about it, and I processed it differently as an adult and now with all the literature that's coming out. But in elementary school, I went to a religious elementary school, and actually most of the Europeans who came were secular, so they went to a general public school. I went to the religious branch of the public school. They were all public schools, and there were more kids from North Africa and the Middle East, which that was also a problem because I was so European, and we were from very different cultures. So that was one culture there, which was totally different from mine. Then at home, everybody was survivors. All my parents' friends, everybody around me were Holocaust survivors. But officially, I mean, informally, everybody spoke about it all the time. That was part of your life experience. There were all kinds of expressions from like before and after, you know, who was what before, and where was he or she during, and second marriages, very common. So that was a whole world. Now, when I got to high school, which was an excellent Israeli high school, most of the kids there were Israeli born, and native Israeli Sabras, and I was integrated into that school very well. I loved that school, and to this day I have some friends in Israel who are from my high school. But there was no talk about the Holocaust. There was almost like a conspiracy of silence. And the little that was talked about was, and I voiced it to my mother, is like sheep to slaughter. How could we have gone like sheep to slaughter? The passivity. Here we are in our own country, defending ourselves, fighting. We are not going to be like you guys. You know, of course, I identified immediately. I moved on to being the Israeli, and I wanted to blend in. But really, there was, if there was any talk about the Holocaust, it was about how we do not want to be. The way we were then, we never ever want to repeat again. But most of the time, there was no official talk of the Holocaust. My mother used to go every year to Yom HaShoah, a ceremony. She would go. And certainly in our day-to-day kitchen talk, if you will, that was part of our lives. And the stories that I was telling you and what went into the interview with my mother was just a part of all the stories that I heard all the time. I do not come from a family where my parents would not talk. My father did not talk as much as my mother. He really was much, he held back much more. By the way, I interviewed him in 1988, so I have 3 cassette tapes about his experiences. But he would not talk very much, except that he had nightmares. He always had nightmares.
While we're on your father, could you tell me what the cigarette case is about?
Oh, yes.
Hold it up and we'll show it.
This is a very interesting item. I don't know how to call it. It's a cigarette case. And it was made by a German artist who was POW in the same camp as my father. Should I show it like this? You can see here, it's very good work, but it's the Soviet Union, the symbol of the Soviet Union. And in the back, there is a Star of David, Magen David. And in Cyrillic letters is the date when my father was captured by the Russians, and the date, I don't know what the significance of May 1st is, because he was not released May 1st. But anyway, this is, and it was done by a German for a Jew in a Soviet POW camp. So I think it's very interesting.
Can you read the writing of it?
I don't know to read Cyrillic. See, I was in the Serbian school only for 2 months. And in Serbia, they teach the Latin alphabet as well as the Cyrillic alphabet. But we left for Israel before we got to the Cyrillic alphabet. So,
The split between talking about it and not talking about it in Israel,
yes.
How it was discussed in Israel. Did you ever confront any of your contemporaries with a different view?
Well, not in high school, but the day arrived when I served in the Israeli army. Now, this is connected to my father. My father, I come from a modern Orthodox background, and in those days, and even today, a religious girl is not does not have to go and serve in the army. All the others do, the secular ones. So my father said to me, this was 1959, since you're religious, you don't have to go and serve in the army. Well, you know, I was my mother's daughter in many ways, and I had my own ideology and my own convictions, and I said, no way, I am going to go. We are not that religious, and I want to serve my country. And I went, and the first year I was just like, most girls in those days worked in offices doing various jobs. But I wanted to do more, so I volunteered. I even changed my medical, I don't know, they had like a profile of health, how healthy you were. You had to be in perfect health to be even asked to go to officer's training or to be tested for officer's training. So I did. I went through the whole thing to change that. Make a long story short, I went to officer's training. And in officer's training, it was interesting. Most of the girls there were native Israelis, a lot of them from kibbutzim. And that was the time when Eichmann was captured. Now, the way girls served in the army, they did, as I said, mostly office jobs or like social work type or education. In the training, we had the basic training with guns and stuff, but that was really not the most important. Most important was the academic part, and also we had to be well-versed in current events. So we had to read the paper every day, and we had discussions about current events. And Eichmann was captured, and the papers were full of details about his capture. And some of the editorials in the papers discussed whether the State of Israel had the right to try Eichmann. And that evening, in our discussion in officers training, that was discussed. Does Israel have the right to try Eichmann for his war crimes? And the debate was going on. And the more I listened, the more upset I got. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore, and I got up and I said, I don't remember how I started, but I said something like, I'm a survivor. That was the first time I came out publicly in like a public forum and said, I am a Holocaust survivor. I'm a survivor. And when we were put on the trains and deported, nobody asked us whether we wanted to go or whether they had the right to do that to us. And I don't remember the words, but I remember how upset I was and how it was not upset. It was like there was something in me from my guts came in terms of stating my identity and my convictions and our right to try Eichmann, not our right, our obligation, our duty to the Jewish people, to the 6 million who perished, and to the survivors. Anyway, I remember how quiet it was when I spoke. I mean, I gave this fiery speech, and it made a big impression. It really did. And that was, I think, the first time I really came out with who I was and what I went through. When we finished officers' training, the parents were invited for the ceremony. And it was a military ceremony, as all, you know, parade, etc. And my father cried. Here's my father who didn't want me to even go and serve in the army. And he said to me, when he congratulated me after the ceremony, he said, I was the dirty Jew, I was the stinky Jew that they wanted to kill. And here is my daughter, an officer in the Israeli army. That was a moment of triumph for him. And later on, when the trial was going on, I went one day to the trial. I went in my uniform as an officer, and I remember seeing him in the glass booth, Eichmann, and I was thinking to myself, he's being tried and they are representing me on my behalf. So I carried this, and on and off, you know, throughout my life, it comes and goes. I cannot say that the Holocaust governs my life, because it does not. My Jewishness does. My Israeliness does. But it translates into it. It is like part and parcel of being Jewish, of this generation. And I think my fervor as a Jew and as an Israeli is partly because of my experiences, my belief system, and my wish for my people and for my children. Like my son served in the Israeli army, and now my baby is nagging about the same thing. And I said, first graduate from college, then we'll talk. But I brainwashed them. Clearly, I brainwashed them. Because their father is an American-born, even though his father left on just about the last boat. He came here from Vienna. And from birth, he was a Jew from Galicia who went to Vienna during World War I and then came to this country. His mother was already American-born, from Duluth, Minnesota. That's where my husband was born and raised. But certainly I brainwashed the kids with this fervor, conviction, belief. I don't know what to call it.
Did you tell them the stories that your mother told you? Did you tell them about your experiences during the war, your own children?
I told them some stories, but I did not have it in an organized fashion until I interviewed my mother. But see, it was my daughter's idea to interview my mother. She was the one who was putting pressure on me. So somehow she got the idea. And when my child number three, my second daughter, was going on March of the Living in Poland. That's when I transcribed the tapes and translated them, written it out, what I had here, and made copies for each one of my children. And they told me that the moment they got it, they read it. They kind of like read the whole thing in one sitting. It's very much part of their legacy. In fact, my most cynical child is my youngest, and he's the one who made the connection between you and me. When he went to Washington and you came to speak to this youth group, I don't know, I think he was about 15 or 16, he approached you and told you, and I would have never guessed that of all my kids, he would take it upon himself. And then when he came back from Washington, he brought me the forms to sign up as a survivor. In 1985, I don't know whether you want me to talk about that a little bit, I decided to go to Europe, take my whole family. It was a costly trip. It was very important to me. We rented a car, a van, a very bad one. They gave us a jalopy. And my oldest was 17. It was 17, 15, 10, and 7. My baby, my Avi, the one who contacted, who talked to you, was only 7 years old. We rented this van and we drove from Holland through Germany to Czechoslovakia, to Hungary, to Austria, and back. You know, like we made the, in fact, I brought a map of how this whole tour took place. And of course, you cannot see anything in depth, but the kids remember that trip vividly. It really whetted their appetite, not just in terms of the Jewish aspect and the survivor aspect, which I will talk about in a minute, but culturally I wanted them to be exposed. On some level, I have the European background, and I wanted them to be exposed to it. Anyway, when we entered Germany, second day, we arrived in Holland Friday, so we spent Shabbat in Amsterdam, and we rented the van Sunday morning, and we started driving. And you know how big Holland is. It didn't take much time. I think in an hour or two, we were in Germany. The moment we entered German soil, I became anxious. And I was afraid. I was regressed. And we spoke all day long about the Holocaust. Then we got to this hotel. I said to my husband, with my own prejudices, I said to him, you'll see, it will be very clean. And sure enough, it was in a small town. And we did not, they had, this was like an inn, you know, kind of almost like a country inn, bed and breakfast. So we had to take three rooms. So my husband and I in one room, the two boys in one room, and the two girls in one room. And at night, I had nightmares all night. I was very restless. In the morning, Danny, my older son, comes in, that Avi, my younger son, couldn't fall asleep. He kept on saying to his brother, what if the Germans change their mind? Because we said, when he got all scared, we said, no, this is peaceful times, and so on and so forth. This was a long time ago. He had a hard time falling asleep, and I felt like, oh my God, I traumatized my child, you know. But he was scared to be in Germany. He picked up my fears. the interesting thing about that trip was that we went to Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia. And then after Hungary, it was very interesting in Hungary because I went back to where my mother's apartment was. We went to the Orthodox shul where my grandfather had a life seat. I don't know how it's called when you buy a seat that is for you. We saw, you know, in the courtyard of the Orthodox shul, there is a frame of a chuppah. And that's where my mother got married the first time. And then I called my parents from Budapest to Israel, and I told them. It's interesting, my mother didn't want us to go to Budapest. She says, I never, ever want to go back there, ever. And I said to her, but I want to go back there because for me it's associated with you. Anyway, when we got to Austria, I wanted to go to Mauthausen. See, I did not know that Moosbierbaum was near Mauthausen. And you have to take the exit of Linz, I think. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. My husband always drives and I navigate, be it in Europe, be it in the United States, and we are avid travelers and we go camping. By and large, I navigate. We missed the exit. And I said, oh my God, I did not pay attention. So this was already a while, you know, we passed Linz exit. So we were debating, should we go back? And then my husband said, you wanted to miss it. You had enough. So we did not go back to Mauthausen. Anyway.
Let me ask you one more thing. It sounds like there are associations that you make regularly.
Yes.
It's trains or barbed wire.
Yes.
You mentioned this being part of your children's legacy. Mm-hmm. But what you said before was that the dominant feeling that you remember from the Holocaust is fear.
Yes.
Is that the legacy?
Yes, it is. I'm afraid of it happening again. I believe it can happen anywhere. And as a matter of fact, genocide is not rare in human history. I don't believe we traveled to China about a year and a half ago. That was not a pleasant trip. And I wrote a collective letter to my kids just about our travel experiences. We went all the way to Tibet. We flew inside China like 8 times. It was interesting. But I felt very uncomfortable in China. And in that collective letter, I write something, never in my life did I feel so depersonalized as in China. A friend of mine wanted to read the letter. So she read it. She's a social worker. And she stumbled upon this line, which was totally my unconscious. So she said to me, Nomi, do you make the connection? I said, not until you pointed it out to me. I felt depersonalized, dehumanized in China. And I guess their suffering and their history and what they do to each other within China in terms of the oppression. But each time it resonates with me. It is it puts fear in my heart, or rather revives the fear that is in my heart. In fact, you know, even politically, how I am in Israel, how I align myself, I see the Palestinians' plight, you know. I feel for them. It's hard for me not to. Now, my father will tell you they want to kill us, you know, like he, for him, for all of us, it evokes the Holocaust. It's impossible not to. But the question is how it evokes it for you. So, quite a few, like my father or my brother, they say the Arabs are trying to wipe us out. We have to be strong this time, not let them. And I somehow see the Palestinians as being the victims, and I see myself as victimized. So I don't want to victimize others. I have a hard time with it, even though I realize, you know, the security issues and so on and so forth. And I'm convinced that if they would have won the War of Independence, they would have wiped us out, or any other war for that matter. But for me, it is the fear and the belief that it can happen again to the Jewish people as well as other people. But you know what? There is another legacy. The legacy is also of those stories that I insisted on telling here today, of these anonymous people who rose to the occasion, who did for people they did not even know. I think that's hopeful. I don't know when I am going to be asked to rise to the occasion. And these were simple people who rose to the occasion.
Maybe that's a good place to stop, somewhere between fear and hope.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Sid.